Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Hope you guys are all doing well tonight. We've officially turned into spring, although you would not know it here yet, so I'm looking forward to it. Last week and this week have been cloudy, cool, and rainy, so just kind of gloomy and yuck day after day after day after day. So I'm really looking forward to some sunshine, and I guess the rain is good, though, because I'm starting to see some of the what will be iris pushing up, and so glad that winter is over. I've never liked winter very much, but during this pandemic, and I'm not one that goes out like a lot of our listeners here, much due to underlying conditions. This was a really tough winter. I didn't notice quite as much back in the spring and summer because we were still out driving into the country, taking pictures and doing that kind of thing. But then it struck me when winter came. Oh my God, we won't really be going out because it gets pretty cold here in Nebraska, and we don't really go in anywhere, so be forced to be creative with time. But anyway, glad you're all here. And for those of you who may be new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice, and I'm listening. That's the first time I've ever said that. And you know, tonight, our guest is a lot of things, but one of them is an actor. And my husband and I started watching an old program, some of you won't be old enough to remember, but called Frasier, and it's about, an online psychiatrist, and that's what he's been saying, and I've been watching every night. Many of you know my husband and I are opposites. He's a morning person, and I'm a night owl, so he's got toothpicks in his eyes at about 7:30 trying to be a sport and at least stay up till 8 o'clock with me. And so we found Frasier, you know, it started playing that half-hour show, and so I thought tonight I would try that out. I've been listening to him saying, this is Frasier Crane, and I'm listening. So hopefully my guest who I'm going to bring on right now will appreciate that and get a little bit of a giggle because, like I said, one of his things is that he's an actor. In fact, Mike Anthony has been a professional actor and non-professional bartender since he graduated from Wayne State University with a Master of Arts degree in theater. His first book, Life at Hamilton, chronicles the extraordinary time he's bartender with an up-close perspective of Hamilton, an American musical as it rocketed into Broadway history. Beyond his life in theater, Mike's journey took an unexpected turn when his dad passed, leading him down a remarkable path of discovery. He now spends a good portion of his time exploring evidence suggestive of the survival of consciousness beyond the demise of the physical body. A part of Mike's story is told in the 2021 Netflix documentary series, Surviving Death. His new book release, Love, Dad, outlines the journey in quest for answers. Mike is on a hiatus due to COVID, where he's in the midst of working on several projects, including his next book and a documentary. For more, see MikeAnthony.com. And I'll be repeating that a couple times in the show, but most of you know, and if you don't, these links to the show are posted all across social media. And in the program notes, I always put my guest's website. So if you're not by a pen right now, you can always go to braininjuryradio.com or inaflash.org or any of the many places on social media that you find my promo, and you will find Mike Anthony's site. So with that, I am going to bring him on right now. I think, how you doing tonight, Mike?
Hi, Kim. I'm doing very well, and I want you to know I immediately picked up on your Frasier reference.
That's the first time I've ever done it, but Gary and I started watching that. You know, like he'll always say, I'll look over, and I can tell that he's toast. You know, he's about ready to nod off, and I'll say, do you want to watch one more show? And I'm like, knowing that I'm doing that to him, right? And he's like, well, maybe a half-hour show. And I'm like, okay, so we got this Cox Contour thing, and I came across Frasier, and I hadn't seen it since it was actually on TV, whenever that was, whatever decade that was. And we started watching it, and it is pretty funny, you know. And so I keep watching that, and he's like, this is Frasier Crane, and I'm listening. And so I thought, God, I'm going to have to do that on the radio some night. And then I was looking over the weekend. I'm like, oh, Mike's going to be on, and he's an actor. He might appreciate me doing that if I'm going to test drive that I'm Kim and I'm listening. So, yeah, that's pretty funny. And, you know, tell me Frasier's – this is Brain Injury Radio, by the way, where we forget a lot. His name?
The actor?
Frasier's real. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Now I have forgotten it myself. oh, goodness gracious.
Wait. We'll think of it, but I'll just say this. Let's go full circle. On the last Wednesday of every month, I decided a few years ago to bring a co-host on with me, and he's a fellow from England, and he wrote a book. He had a brain injury, and he wrote a book, and when it came time to do his audio book, Kelsey Grammer, thank you.
Kelsey Grammer, there it is.
It just happens that way sometimes. Kelsey Grammer actually narrated Simon's book, and so it kind of goes full circle. I wasn't even thinking of that. I was thinking of Eddie the dog the night that I put Frasier on the first time for Gary and I to watch, and then we kept watching it, and I kind of forgot about the fact that he had narrated Simon's book. And anyway, I just thought that was kind of funny that you'd be coming on tonight and I'd be trying out that line. And then it occurred to me that Kelsey Grammer had narrated Simon's book, but that didn't occur to me any of this time that I've been watching the show. So
all sorts of connections. Well, I think it works really well for you. I'd keep it if I were you.
All right. Well, tell me, before we get into Dear Dad, Love Dad, excuse me, which, by the way, I want to tell you was written so well. I really enjoyed, actually, my husband wanted me to pass a message because he doesn't see me. I'm talking more these days than reading a lot of time. I'm listening to audiobooks because I've got some visual impairment, but I have been reading your book, but my husband is a voracious reader, and when you sent it, he picked it up and he said, "Do you care if I read this?" I said, "No, please do." And then I'd like a book report. You know, give me a book report then. I would love it if you'd read it. And so he did, and he wanted me to pass on. I'd let him, but of course he's been in bed for an hour. He wanted me to tell you just how wonderful and well-written he thought your book is, and is looking forward to reading Hamilton as well. And so I'm probably halfway through it, but he took it away from me at that point, and he read your whole book and at that point. So I'll go back and catch up. But yes, it is. It's for those of you listening, if you're like me, it's well written. It's very thoughtful ideas, but not written in a way that's over your head at all. I know my listeners, you guys will all get it, and I think you will really enjoy reading this book. So I encourage you to check out Love Dad. I can't speak to Hamilton yet. I haven't read it, but I'm sure that it's probably a really good book too, because it's the same guy. So, you know, got to have the same voice. They were written in a proximity. They're just two totally different subjects. But since sequentially, I guess, Hamilton probably came first because you were being an actor, why don't you give us a little bit of background, Mike, about you and what was going on in your life, what you were doing in your life, whether you want to include the Hamilton book in that or not is up to you, depending on that timing. And then we will get to the point where we talk about what happened to change the course of what you were doing in your life and embark on this journey.
Sure, yeah. Well, I had originally I graduated from college with a degree in acting, and I had gone to college to be a science teacher, actually. That's how I had planned on spending my life, being a science teacher. I'd always done some acting on the side, and I was minoring in theater while I was taking my science courses. And then I ended up just, you know, absolutely falling in love with theater, and that became the focus of my time in my life. And so that's where I ended up getting the degree in. And then I moved to New York City, you know, which is one of the, in America, you've got basically New York or LA. Those were kind of the two big acting destinations, among some others as well. And moved to New York, expecting that my, you know, I had no doubt I was going to be a very successful actor. I mean, I had done perfectly well at a very tiny school in New Hampshire, and I was sure that was going to translate to success on Broadway. But like most actors, you know, it's a tough business, and almost all actors have some sort of a day job, quote unquote. So I took one eventually as a bartender for a Broadway show, you know, which I thought I'd have for a couple of months until I was able to pay the bills with my extraordinary acting. And then 14 years went by, I was still behind that bar, and as it turns out, the acting is not quite extraordinary enough to make a living in my case. So, I ended up having this job that I thought was going to be this very temporary thing, and it ended up being, you know, just a lovely turn of events in my life. I've had such wonderful experiences bartending there, and that's what the book Life at Hamilton is. It's actually my I had this very privileged perspective of Hamilton from up close, and I was seeing all of these things every day, and so that's where Life at Hamilton comes from. That came after my dad's passing. So would you like me to go into that?
Well, I think we'll back up with that for just 1 minute, and then we'll go on with that. That is, I just would like to comment that that's cool, and I will be looking forward to looking at Hamilton too. It's neat when we're able to have an experience. You know, a lot of people, for different reasons, but a lot of our listeners here were going on about whatever they were doing in their life and setting their goals, and a brain injury interrupted their life, and a large percentage of us couldn't go back and do exactly what we were doing before, and it took a long time swimming against the tide to figure that out. And then what I call a tweener stage, where you're just kind of dawning on you, you can't go back, but you don't know what forward looks like. And so one of the things I like to encourage people to do is to try different things. And the experience you got to have around Hamilton, and even though you know, you didn't hit the big screen like maybe you had intended, or the big stage that you had intended when you went into it, the actual process of what you did for every minute you were doing it was worth the price of admission, was worth the try, even though it didn't evolve exactly the way that you wanted or thought it would. So I always, I'm really happy to hear about that, and I'm really happy that you wrote about it, because it's encouraging. Just because we get a rigid idea in our head of what we want to do, when we have different ways of gauging success and failure, you know, through my journey, my definition of those things has changed quite a bit. And to me now, you know, the success was the try that you did, you know, and the reward, the success was all of that you experienced in the 14 years, which would be super awesome to be an insider, but not have to have the same type of pressure on you as the people that were acting. You know, you got to be fly on the wall, so to speak, you know, which I think would be a really awesome experience to be able to have. And so you just never know how things are going to roll unless you try it. Right. All you know is that if you don't try and you stay benched and, you know, looking out the window instead of going out and trying, you know, is a pretty miserable life. And we're all kind of learning about that a little bit this last year, you know, with COVID and none of us being able to do the things that most all of us not being able to do the things that we had planned to do. But this is a good time to do things like write a book. You know, they're just about all of you out there have thought about it, have wanted to, have started one, someday would like to. You know, these spaces that we have that are going on right now is a really good time to try a new hobby that you've been thinking about. Maybe start journaling, do some yoga. You know, I don't know what your thing is going to be, but something different that you've just thought about that you haven't actually made that move to try yet, this time has opened. As much as we all hate it and it's scary, it is an opportunity to try something different, because that door has been opened when a lot of others have been closed. And so for the people that are really going stir crazy, the only suggestion I can make to not driving yourself crazy going stir crazy is to stimulate your brain by doing something different and turning that negative into a positive. So anyway, that's all I want to say about that, is just that I think that was an awesome experience that you had. And Anxious, the book is called Life at Hamilton. Sometimes you throw away your shot only to find your story, by Mike Anthony. And I encourage you to check that out for that sort of a read. But one of the reasons, aside from Hamilton, that I wanted Mike to come on tonight was his book, Love Dad, and an experience that happened, and I'm going to let Mike tell you about that. But it also triggered his life going in a different direction. And he'll explain it better than I will, but again, this was not in his plans at all. In fact, he was just starting to tell you when I interrupted. You know, he was in school, going to be a science teacher and an acting minor, and life on life's terms happened, and that triggered a journey that very meaningful for him and his family, changed his outlook. But so many of you wonder, and I hear it all the time, the wondering about what happens when we die. And with that, I think I'm just going to let Mike tell some of his story and what happened. But it's something that we all wonder about. A lot of people fear it. Some of us have had experiences where we don't fear it. We fear getting there, but not the destination at all. And so I always like people who've had these experiences, and Mike's is in a different way than some of them that we hear. In fact, we haven't heard a story quite like his before, and I thought this would be a great compatible way to tell what I view to be a truth in a totally different way. So no matter how you get there, that truth winds up being exactly that, a truth that people can hang on to. There's a lot of things that preclude people from believing it, but nonetheless, we continue to try to get that message out. So tell us what happened in your life, Mike, that triggered Sure. this journey and how it went.
Sure, yeah. Death is something that, as you said, it's always in the background, right? It's something that we know about our whole lives. There's a show on Netflix now called The Good Place that's pretty popular, and it's about, you know, life after death, and there are these people in the afterlife. And in one of the scenes, one of the lead characters is trying to explain to an angel who's an immortal being what it's like to be a human. And he's not grasping it. He can't get it because he's immortal and he knows he's immortal. And she says to him, you know, we all know about death, so we're all a little bit sad all the time. And that resonated with me. I remember really the first time death entered my life was when my grandfather died, my father's father. He was only about 60 years old when he passed. And I was maybe five or six or something. And seeing my dad crying about his dad being gone, you know, that was heartbreaking. And that's when the idea of death was for the first time sort of tangible in my life. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, my dad's father just died. That means someday my dad is going to die. You know, my parents are not going to be here anymore. And that thought I couldn't handle. You know what I mean? It really drove me crazy, the idea of them not being here someday. So I pushed it way down deep into my subconscious, I think. The idea of death, I tried to push away as much as I could, and I just didn't want to think about that for obvious reasons. I would rather just have a happy, go-lucky life and imagine that we're all going to live forever. And then when I got to middle school, high school, and college, and I started, as I said, you know, taking science classes, particularly in college, and according to the mainstream scientific materialist paradigm, there is no life after death, right? Again, this is just simply according to our mainstream scientific paradigm, which believes that what we think of as the self, as us, is an illusion created by the brain, and it's made by chemical reactions happening. And once the brain stops getting oxygen and the chemical reactions stop occurring, the sense of self goes away, and that person goes away forever. So that never felt totally right to me. Ever since I was a little kid, I'd always felt like there's more going on than meets the eye. You know, I'd always felt a connection to something bigger than me, something that I felt like I couldn't grasp and that I probably would never be able to grasp while I was living this human life through this human brain. So I put those notions away, and then I became an actor instead, and I'm living this happy life in New York, bartending now and having the time of my life in New York, working every day with my friends. And then one night, just as intermission is about to begin, and you know, intermission on Broadway, the curtain comes down and the lights come up, and then, you know, 1,000 people rush to the bar to get their drink thing. And just before that intermission, my phone rings and it's my sister, and I picked it up, and she is wailing. She's sobbing and moaning on the phone, saying, "He's gone, he's gone, he's gone." And to this day, those are the worst words I've ever heard, the worst sounds I've ever heard. And then my mom was screaming in the background as well. As it had turned out, my dad, who just like his father, he was only 60 years old. But unlike my grandfather was a very, very big man, you know, very heavy, and he smoked. He was a chain smoker his whole life. So I had always used that in my mind to say, well, if I don't smoke and if I watch my diet, you know, and if my dad does that too, he will not have the same fate as his father. And my dad was in great shape as far as we knew. You know, we thought that if anyone in my family had a good shot of making it to their 90s or even 100, it was probably my father because of how active he was and how healthy he seemed. So getting that phone call that he had suddenly died was an utter shock. I mean, it's impossible to describe what the moment was like getting that phone call. You know, I have this memory of I went into absolute shock, and I have this memory of hanging up the phone, and now I'm the theater patrons, and they're all happy and giddy. It was a comedy that I was working at that time, so everyone's happy from the first act, and this woman orders a rum and coke for me, and I'm making her drink, and I'm asking her, "How's the show? You know, are you enjoying the show?" And I went through the whole intermission somehow with this news in my head, and so inside my inner world was totally crumbling, while outside I'm like making these drinks and making small talk. It was just an utterly bizarre experience. So that's how I got the phone. That's how I got the news that my dad had suddenly died.
God, I can't believe that you were able to put. You were a much better actor than you gave yourself credit for to make it through intermission. You must have been a lot in shock, too.
Total shock. I now recognize that I was in total shock. After I was the bar manager, so I was in charge of, you know, paying everybody out their tips and everything at the end of the night. So I did all of that stuff. I did all of my normal routine, and then my family lives in Connecticut, so after the shift ended, I started walking to Grand Central to head home to Connecticut to be with my family. And on that walk home, I started to have my very first panic attack, the first panic attack of my life. So that's when it sort of hit me, was when I was alone on the street.
I gotcha. Oh, geez. And a ways away.
Yes.
I can't even imagine what that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can't even imagine what that was like, that two-hour train ride.
Yeah, it was rough, you know. I describe all of that in the book, what that moment was like. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a shattering event. It ended up kicking off in me what I would call a full-blown existential crisis. You know, like I said, even though I'd always loved science, and science says that everybody, you know, there's no such thing as life after death, I had always believed science was wrong about that, that there was a lot going on that we couldn't detect, that maybe our scientific instruments were not strong enough to detect. You know, I'd always believed, use the word believe, I'd always believed that there's more to the story, and that I think maybe we do go live beyond death. But when my dad suddenly died, that belief was no longer nearly enough. And I was suddenly being crushed by the lectures my college biology professors gave me. You know, I was suddenly being completely smothered by the scientific idea that my dad was now forever gone. That I couldn't handle.
Right.
And I started thinking, if someone as wonderful as my father was this just innately wonderful human being, you know, just not your normal human being. And if someone as wonderful as that could just disappear, then I was like, well, I'm not, what is the point of doing anything at all? Why do we build these skyscrapers? Why do we have sports games? Why do we do all this stuff? If all of this can just disappear like that, like we've never been here before. And that's sort of where that's where my mental state was in the days immediately following my dad's death.
And what did he die of so suddenly?
We assumed it was some sort of a major cardiac event. He was found. He and I had just been together. We had just watched a Monday night football game together at my mother's house. He and my mom had gotten divorced when they were very young, but they stayed close and they stayed friends their whole life. So he lived right around the corner from my mom. So we watched the football game. I hug him. I say, I love you. He says, I love you too, which means those are the last words we ever said to each other. So that's nice to have. He goes, drives around the corner to his house. He walks inside, goes up the steps, and dies. He still had his keys in his hand. So we just assumed it must have been a stroke or aneurysm or just something very fast.
Yeah, that'll do it. That's what I had, a ruptured brain aneurysm. And it's quick.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. It certainly seemed like it was quick. He was on the ground, and the way that he, of course, I studied the position of his body for, you know, months and months. I could not let it go because I had this intense fear that he had felt pain or something, and then he got afraid, and he maybe tried to make it to the phone, and he was all alone, and that thought was killing me. The idea that my dad, you know, just I couldn't stop thinking about what his last moments were like. And the idea that he might have been afraid, I just couldn't handle that at all. So I studied and studied the position that his body was in and the way that it looked. He was on the floor and his knees were bent, like as the, you know, and up as though he had like laid down to take a nap in the middle of the floor for some reason. So we wondered if maybe he had like gotten dizzy or something and then kneeled down. And that's why his knees were in the shape that they were and why he still had his keys in his hands. And so anyway, all of the indications pointed to something just very, very fast.
For the family, that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
For the person, it's a good way to go.
Oh, yeah.
When it's your time, what I tell people is kind of something, well, what you say in the book in a different way is I say, none of us get out of this alive, you know.
Right.
You've
right.
got the birth year and the death year and the dash in between is our life. And
right.
I can just say as someone who experienced that, like a lot of the people listening tonight, that I don't think he was thinking about being alone. When you're overcome with an incredible pain, you're focused on that, and then the journey starts, and you're not even thinking about where you are or the people behind, believe it or not, because you're on your way to transitioning to what you wind up finding out about. So I'm just further confirmation of what you're going to tell us from my side of it, is that as much as I love my family and all of that and my life and everything that's going on in my life, that isn't what I had time to think about.
Right,
because something happens to jolt you so extreme that's immediately where your focus goes. And then they start bringing you from the other side.
I mean,
shut up from there.
No, I love hearing your story, and I'd love to hear more about it. One of the things that has brought me great comfort are stories of near-death experiences. I just fell in love with the idea. So it ended up kicking off this journey for me eventually into the evidence, what evidence might be out there that he did survive in some way. And one of my favorite branches of evidence are near-death experiences. So, but the way that it began, the way that this whole sort of new branch of my life began, was that just days after burying my father, a phone call came into my mom's house from a second cousin of mine who we were not close with, a person who I couldn't even picture this guy when my mom told me who had called. I couldn't even picture who it was. And as it turns out, this second cousin of mine, who is a hospital administrator, that's his day. He has like a big time straight-laced job as a hospital administrator. But what nobody knew about my cousin Chris at the time, and he's only recently, as he says, come out of the paranormal closet. He was doing on the weekends when he wasn't, doing hospital administration tasks. He had a little ghost hunting team, and he and his team would go to houses and try to contact spirits. Right. So this was something my family knew absolutely nothing about. Like I said, I don't know that we'd ever spoken to this guy outside of maybe a wedding we'd gone to when he married my second cousin. He married into the family. So on his team, there is a person who calls herself a medium, right? A person who claims the ability to communicate with deceased people. And I had been familiar with mediumship from the show Crossing Over with John Edward that was on television when I was in high school. And now, there's the Long Island Medium. There's a lot of shows now on television, popular shows about mediumship. So I had been aware of it from that sort of perspective. But again, science says there's no such thing as this, and these people are all liars. I mean, that's what science, mainstream science, says about that. So just a few days after burying my dad, Chris, my second cousin, calls my mom and she says, "Oh, hi, Chris." Shocked that he would be calling her at all because he'd never called the house before. And he said, "Do you know what I do?" And she said, "No." And he told her, "On the weekends I have this ghost hunting group." And she said, "Okay." Now my mom at this point is the depths of despair. She's in the utter depths of despair. Right? I mean, she's totally crushed about my dad being gone. But she's a lovely, lovely woman. So she's listening, but she has no idea what this phone call could possibly be about at this point when he's saying, I do ghost hunting. But she says, okay. And she says, and I have this medium on my team. And What happened was this woman named Christina, again, a person who we had never met and who had never met my dad, they were at a ghost hunt on one weekend. They were investigating some paranormal activity at a house. And this woman said, I have a guy here, a spirit named Robert, not necessarily connected to this house, but he's not going to leave me alone. His name's Robert, and he is desperate to get a message to his family that he's okay. He's desperate. And his family is connected to a fish restaurant. So Chris quickly put it together at that point. Oh, Robert, that's my dad's name, and my sister owns a fish restaurant. So that's how Chris put this together, that this is who the spirit must be. And my dad, according to this woman, Christina, was so insistent about getting this message to us that he was just not going to leave. He was just not going to give up until the message was delivered. And so that's what prompted Chris to make the phone call. And I've talked to him a lot about that since. You know, it was really hard for him to make that phone call because you have no idea how a person is going to react. Right? He had no idea about what our religious beliefs might be, how we might feel about the idea of mediumship or ghost hunting or any of that stuff. So it took a lot of courage for him to make that phone call. And the only reason he did is because, according to the medium, my dad needed it so badly. So my mom called me at work one night. Again, I'm back behind the bar, and she tells me this story. And I said, okay. And now my scientific part of my brain goes into overdrive. And I end up calling Chris, talking to him for a long time about this. And he gives me the name of his medium, Christina. And a few days after that, called her. And that was how my investigation into the possibility of mediumship began, my sort of casual investigation. So I called Christina, and my first order of business, really, frankly, was trying to determine if this woman was crazy, right? That was, frankly, in my mind, she either was just, you know, out of her mind, or she really believed what she was saying, but it might not be true, or she was just lying about it. But very quickly into the phone call with her, it was clear that this was a lovely human being. Like, she's lovely and warm and wonderful and compassionate. And people ask me all the time, by the way, there was no money involved in this at all. There was never a dime exchanged for this. This was completely something that this woman was doing out of the kindness of her heart. And I came away from that conversation thinking that at the very least, she believes what she's saying. And then she said some other things on that phone call about my dad. About things that had happened that I couldn't figure out how she could have known. And I tell that whole story in detail in the book. But that experience made me wonder, could there be anything to this? And given how much we were hurting, given how much we loved my dad, given how amazing of a man he was, if there was any chance that this could be real, if there was any chance at all that my poor father was somehow on the other side desperately sweating as he's trying to get this message to us, the least I could do was try to figure out if that's what was happening. And that's what I began to do.
Well, he did leave without getting to say goodbye. You know, when I said that earlier about ways to go, you know, people that have other type of illnesses that are lengthy illnesses, at the end, it's still very hard for the family, but they've had time to process.
Right.
And when something happens as quick as your dad's deal happened for him, that was good. But it sounds to me like by the time his transition was made, he was able and feel bad about you guys' pain.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you didn't get to have that kind of closure or having him have a lengthy illness or even a short illness. No warning at all. Just boom, like you said, boom, and and it was gone. So I can see why he was really wanting to let you guys know. He arrived at his destination is where I'm going to leave it for a moment. In the kindest way, you know, just to let you guys know, because, okay, so, and don't tell because it's in the book, but she did say things. Let's address a little about mediums for a moment. I'm aware, like you are, although I haven't watched that show, I guess what I personally believe is that there are a lot of charlatans in every single industry. Right. And when people are hurting and desperate, if you're at least an intuitive, sensitive person, and you've ever been through the death of someone close to you, then there's a lot of things that you can say for a person who's really wanting to hear something. And you're an actor, so you get this too. There's some element of that to it. That they can say some things and bring comfort, which is a good thing. But why a lot of people would be skeptical. But in Christina's case, she was actually specific enough about a couple of things that your cousin, who you weren't close to, I've got relatives like that, we all do, I think, that have married into the family, and you see them at a wedding or a funeral, but you really don't know them from a bottle of Vicks, let alone who their friends are.
Right.
So this person, you know, once removed, twice removed or whatever, was actually able to say a couple things specific enough to you that there's no way she could have had a lucky guess.
That's right. Because, I was acutely aware that it would be very easy to fool me at this point. When you're grieving in the way that I was and that my family was, you're grasping for anything at all. And I now know, after a great deal of study, that, I mean, the history of mediumship is riddled with people who have been frauds. You know, it's riddled with it, so much so that the study of it is considered to be a silly endeavor. You know, if a serious scientist today wants to take a look at mediumship as an actual phenomenon and study to see whether or not there's any data supportive of the possibility that it's a genuine human ability, that scientist has an enormous hill to climb if he works at a university, for instance. In order to get the university to okay a line of inquiry that involves mediumship, it's almost impossible. And that's because people who have faked it in the past, those stories are the ones that are at the top of our mind. And we end up sweeping under the rug the enormous amount of evidence that is out there from some of the greatest scientists, some renowned scientists of the past have looked into this stuff. I now know, after years of looking into this. But that stuff gets swept under the rug. But anyway, I was acutely aware that this was something that could be easily faked. It would not take much. If you were a person who had no qualms about lying in this way, I mean, it takes a certain sort of person to do this, I think. But if you were that sort of person, you could easily say some stuff and say, "Listen, I do communicate with dead people, and I've got your grandfather here. Did he like playing chess, by the way?" I mean, like, a lot of people can make a connection, right?
Yeah.
If I say the word chess, they can make a connection in their life. I could be a great medium if I was an unscrupulous person who didn't mind being a charlatan, really, in that way. And some people make a great living doing this stuff too. So understandably, there's a lot of skepticism about mediumship. And that was why I went to the lengths that I did to figure out whether or not what was happening here for us and my family was real. And that's what the book is. It's my lengthy investigation into whether or not this could be real. I ended up testing the mediums. So what happened is after this phone call came into the house and I had this long conversation with Christina, and she seemed to me like a genuinely good person who was being honest with me about her experience. My sister, not long after that, is driving to work, and she hears a professional medium on the radio, someone who calls herself a professional evidential medium. Her name's Angelina Diana here in Connecticut, and she was doing a radio segment where people were calling in, and she's giving them readings over the air. And my sister found the timing pretty strange because we had just had this experience with this, not professional medium. And then she hears this person on the radio, so she makes an appointment with her. This woman now is going to come to our house, this professional, and do a reading. And that was my chance to do my first casual test. And I ended up speaking with my dad, and I decided I wanted him to give me a very specific message. I came up with a code word, and I told him, if you do not say this thing, if you don't say this very specific thing, it doesn't matter what else this woman does, I'm not going to believe this is real. I need you to deliver me this very specific message. And I don't know if you want me to go into that story or not, but the bottom line was she ended up delivering that message, and that's where that moment changed my life.
Amazing. And again, just going back for a minute to Christina, I think it's important as we're moving forward that just repeating, this wasn't something with Christina that you went and looked for, and there was no money exchange. So
right.
She did what I would think it would be incumbent on her to do in with her gift.
Yeah.
You know, she was being
right.
implored to do a favor, and I mean,
yeah.
I would, you know, if
yeah.
someone asked you for a favor of something that you could easily do, you would
right.
probably do it. You seem like that kind of guy.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a lot
yeah,
of us that would.
Yeah.
And so there was no incentive, no reason for this gal to,
no.
or your cousin, you know, to go on and repeat it. How did your mom react to your cousin when he called initially?
I tell that story in the book. I mean, she was, for the first, 5 minutes of the phone call, she was just kind of stunned trying to figure out, because it took Chris a little while to get to the point. You know, I think he was trying to figure
yeah.
out whether or not he really wanted to do this or not. You know,
mm-hmm.
if he really wanted to say, you know, I'm a ghost hunter and there's a medium and I think your dead ex-husband just came to us. So, but my mom is very open-minded, and she's a lovely human being as well. So she of course would listen to anything anyone had to say. And Chris is a great guy as well. My cousin's a great guy. These are all good people in this story, you know. So and as you said, no one in it had any motivation to be doing anything deceitful. So, you know, she was very open to the idea, and the possibility was a beautiful one to think about. But my mom, you know, is also a scientifically minded person. She's a nurse. You know, she'd been a registered nurse since she was a kid, basically. And science had always been a big part of her life as well. So, you know, she's not someone who is going to believe something without evidence herself. But she was intrigued. She was at least intrigued.
Yeah. Willing to hear more. So,
yes,
and that is
yes.
incredible timing that medium, that your sister happened to be listening to the radio when she was
yeah.
driving, and that would happen to be on,
right.
and that you would get a hold of her. Interesting. Okay, so when you got this message, and now if your father's goal had been to let you know he made it, he's okay, then that particular visit you just discussed would have done that. But that didn't end your journey.
Right, right. It did it for a few minutes. You know, the way that in the moment when it happened, I felt like I was floating. You know, it's like a moment where, and I've now had multiple moments like this, where you touch something that feels mystical, if that's the right word. It feels like you're touching something that is outside of the reality your brain has come to believe in as the reality, right? The reality that we can see and feel and hear. There are moments where things happen that kind of put a crack into that reality, at least in my case, and show a glimmer of something beyond that reality. And that's what that moment was like. I felt like I'd been let in on a secret, like a secret of the universe, and I wanted to share it with everybody. You know, I felt like I wanted to shout from the rooftops, you're not going to believe what just happened. You know, it felt like such important information for people to be able to have access to that, oh my gosh, there's evidence. I think there's real evidence that my father, who's not in a body anymore, is trying to communicate with me. You know, it felt like that is something everyone should know about, or at least be able to know about, right?
Absolutely.
Shortly after that. Yeah, yeah. The way that my brain works, not long after that, as impossible as cheating would have been for her, I started thinking, like, well, what if? What if she hired a private detective who had a very sensitive, you know, maybe this guy used to work for the CIA, and in his back pocket he carries audio equipment that allows him to hear into a house in the backwoods of a lot in Connecticut. Maybe there was some guy stationed out in my woods who was listening to me some sort of satellite thing or something. You know, as silly as that is, I mean, I understand that that's an absurd thing, and I am absolutely certain this woman, Angelina Diana, does not have an ex-CIA operative who stands in the woods and listens to people's conversations. But
no, but the natural skepticism started setting in, and that's what happens when you're so excited to tell the world about your new find, is there's going to be people that are going to react with that skepticism because it just doesn't filter through their sense of reality. So then you're a little more, at least I am, a little more careful who I talk to about these things.
Yes.
You know, this winds up being a gift too, in that there's a time and place where sharing this information can be very healing and compassionate and a gift for other people to know. And I felt like you in the beginning about telling people, and you know, there's others who just really react almost in a hostile way. There's those that react in a skeptical way, and some that react almost in a hostile way because it just defies their sense of reality to such a degree they can't even allow themselves to think that way. So then I think you filtered a little. So it sounds like, operative or not, that at that point you had gotten a communication, but still he was gone. You couldn't call him at will. And I could see where your mind, in your grief, that skepticism would set in, because that's a hard thing to accept. You're talking about the science and you know, last week, unrelated, and then don't forget where you're at, we were talking about, you know, COVID a little bit last week, and we were talking about, you know, no matter what channel you listen to, it's follow the science, follow the science, follow the science. And I made a comment about they keep moving the goalposts on the science, though. You know, so it's getting to be real confusing and scary to know who to believe, because they keep the science keeps moving the goalposts. And then, you know, it dawned on me, like, it probably has before and I forgot, or maybe it never has and I'm just a slow study. But, you know, last week I said on the air, but then science really is things that are proven. And it's, you know, you only follow the science because it's, science is based on what's been proven at the time. Like the world was flat once, science would have told us, you know, that the world was flat. But more facts, more was revealed, more information came into play, and that changed the science of whatever on its face, you know, and that's kind of what's going on with COVID right now, is that it's new, you know, it hasn't happened before. Things like it have happened. They can make educated guesses, and that's another thing that's scary and frustrating to people because, you know, if they make an educated guess and it fits and you start, okay, I can go with that. I can go with that. And then the next week the goalposts are changed. Oh, my God. I can't go with that. You know, and for some reason, and you found this out and you talk about it, the science about what happens when we die, there are scientists who have talked about it, but they can't seem to nail the exact science. In fact, I talk about, I was married to someone, I was putting through medical school when my incident happened, and talk about skeptic, you know, someone I trusted. Mm-hmm. And one of the first people, my mom was actually the first, and the evidence in it is I had been in a coma for 11 days, and I said something as I was starting to come out of it, and my mom was alone in the room with me, and I said, the colors are so bright. And then I didn't come like back to consciousness for another day or two, but she clearly heard me. And so when I told a story later, when it came back to me, she believed me instantly. But even though I had no reason to lie, see, there's so many different kinds of people. You know, my husband at the time, my first husband, had no reason to think I was a liar. Mm-hmm. He just thought I naively believed something, that it was the medication.
Right.
You know, I was, but I knew this as a fact. It's hard to describe, but just like the sun coming up in the morning, when you see the sun come up in the morning or the moon come up at night, it just is. There was no question, none whatsoever in my mind. It was an instant fact. Now, nothing like that has ever happened in my life that hasn't been actually factual. You know what I mean? Right. There's always been a question. Unless it was a fact. And so when he just would not believe me and wanted to explain it away with science, I just said, we're not going to have much of a future together. In fact, you're leaving. It wasn't quite like that, but kind of like that, because that was going to be a precursor to how my life just had changed completely. We weren't going to be on the same path anymore. You know, he could go be a doctor and do that. Happy to pay for that, you know, but here he was, someone who was in science, who absolutely was not going to be able to believe that. Even knowing I was a credible source. What he knew is what you said about the medium. He knew that I believed it. But the science he had seen in medical school didn't substantiate what I was telling him in such detail.
Right.
And so there's a big divide right there, because there's two people who ain't going to change their mind. I certainly wasn't going to.
Yeah,
mine was evidence-based. You know, it was evidence-based. It just was.
Yes.
Just because he hadn't seen it. And that's really what science is about. You know, what we haven't seen. When they're talking about science all the time, they're talking about what they know. Science is subject to change. With additional information.
Oh yes, yes.
All
see,
the
I
time.
Think we too often we confuse the word science, which is a method, right? Science is a method, but we start to think of it as the body of knowledge that method has accumulated, and as you said, that body of knowledge is ever shifting. It's ever shifting. You know, when Newton was around and the apple fell on his head and he had the eureka moment about gravity, and he came up with these beautiful equations that described acceleration and how long it would take a rock that was thrown with this amount of force to reach a tree across a field that was, you know, 100 feet away. Those equations worked beautifully. And they worked so beautifully, in fact, that we thought, oh, well, now we've gotten this figured out. Newton just figured out physics. He just cracked gravity and we've gotten that figured out. But then years later, of course, Einstein comes along, and Einstein says, no, that's not the whole story. And he comes up with the theory of relativity. So now Newtonian physics don't quite fit with Einsteinian physics, right? And as it turns out, Einstein had a closer handle on the truth than Newton did, right? But then Max Planck and Bohm and quantum physics comes along, right, which Einstein, to his dying day, did not think, he thought that was inaccurate. As it turns out, we now, you know, since Einstein's passing, we have now done countless experiments that have proven some of the aspects of quantum mechanics and quantum physics that Einstein thought were impossible, we now know definitely happened. We know that in a lab. So as it turned out, Einstein, though he was closer to the truth, right, if that's the right word, than Newton was, he didn't have the ultimate truth. And now quantum physics, we might say, describes reality better than Einstein was able to describe reality. But we're constantly at a new precipice of understanding, constantly. So for any scientist, like your ex or anyone else who says that anything is impossible, to me that is a silly stance to take. Because the bottom line is, where we are now with quantum physics, we now understand how little we understand. The very foundation that our science is built on, the very physical foundation, right? We for a long time we thought atoms were the smallest bits of matter, and then we get to protons, neutrons, and electrons. And then now we think those are made up of quarks, right? What makes up a quark? We don't know. There are theories. One of the main theories, for instance, is string theory, right? A vibrating string of energy, whatever that is.
Yes.
Nobody really knows what that energy could be, by the way. And then let's say that is true. It's a vibrating string of energy. What is making the string vibrate? We have absolutely no idea. So what this means is the very foundations of our science, the very foundational level that everything else is built on, we do not understand. It could be anything. And quantum physics is like weirder than any NDE story I've ever heard, right? If you really look into quantum physics, it's bizarre. And we're just now, scientists are trying to come to terms with how all of this works and what it all means, you know? So all of that is just to say that for any scientist to tell you that anything is impossible, that an experience that you've had that you know for you is real, for anyone to say it was not real, to me that just seems silly. And there are things that happen, like what happened to you, that cannot be brought into a lab and tested. And that's the problem. Science as a method, again, science is a method by which we observe something in the world, and then we use that method to try to figure out what the heck it is that we're observing and why that thing happens. But people who have an experience like you have, you know, tell me what the scientific instrument is that could possibly follow you to wherever it is that you went, where you saw those colors. What scientific instrument is that that could measure those colors. We don't have that, and we maybe never will. But that doesn't mean just because we can't measure the thing that happened to you, just because you're the only one who experienced it, does not mean it didn't happen. And just because we can't stick a microscope into the situation somehow or some other instrument, just because we can't do that does not mean the thing didn't happen. So there are things that science just isn't good for, right? For the sort of science that we are taught at like the university level, for instance, replicability is a big important thing. You have to be able to replicate it until something, you know, there's an old adage in science that until it happens twice in science, it hasn't happened. But that doesn't work for the rest of, for all of reality. Because clearly what happened to you happened, right? So those are the limits of science. And where my own journey ended, where the book ends, I won't go into the whole story because it's better if you lead up to it by reading the whole book, because it's going to be fast what a lot of people think of as possible. But I ended up having an experience that was unequivocal. I mean, it happened. It happened physically. Everyone in the room saw it. I was sitting beside a New York Times journalist when it happened, and she has also written about this. And I only mention that because if you're a journalist for a major newspaper like that, you have to be very careful about what you print, right? Your word is your whole livelihood. So her name is Leslie Kane. You can trust that if she's writing about this, it really happened. You have to be very careful about what she says. And it happened. And because I have that experience where I saw and felt what I did, I now know that no matter how smart a scientist is, and granted, most of the people that I speak to are smarter than I am, right? I am of average intelligence. I've got like an average IQ. Most of the people that I've talked to in this journey, most of the scientists are way smarter than I am. But I now know that no matter how many Nobel Prizes might be sitting on that scientist's shelf or your ex-husband's shelf, if he tells me that there is no such thing as anything quote-unquote paranormal, I know they're wrong. It doesn't matter how smart they are. On this particular point, I know they're wrong.
Yeah, to me, I've kind of changed. You know, science was something, like you said, that was proven and was carved in stone. And to me now, a good scientist would have a natural curiosity and always be open to possibility, even if it couldn't be proven right now. To me, it's not a good scientist who thinks that the science is carved into stone and more information couldn't change that. If they haven't seen that in other areas by now, enough to get the big picture, then they're just not very good at what they do, in my mind, you know. So I've come full circle, you know, from being shy about it or feeling, I never questioned myself, but about, you know, who I tell and who I don't tell and how people are going to react, that's really their thing, you know. It's mm-hmm. not my thing. That's mm-hmm. their thing, you know.
Right.
And
right.
The same with the scientists. You know, I used to feel like they had, like you said, I'm just me, you know. They were more highly educated, more trained, smarter than me, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So I cut them a lot of slack for that. And these days, well, after a decade here and some of the miracles I've heard, you know, to me, a good scientist is one that always has an open mind. Even if they have the skepticism, their mind isn't snapped shut without any possibility of moving. You know, because now there's even been Dr. Eben Alexander was a guest of mine one night, and he's an educated doctor who had an experience. You know, there's quite a few out there who have, and so I think it's interesting when you were talking about the fact that there are notable people out there, which I don't even know why you have to be notable, but fine, if they get more credibility for their experience because they're a doctor,
right,
fine.
Right.
If they were the ones,
right,
that slammed,
right,
the door on it, I guess they're the ones that could open the door a crack on it, you know.
Right.
Fine.
Right.
Still isn't common reality for a lot of people. There's still so many people questioning. This is really weird. Yesterday I was talking to, and in fact I sent him a link, and Denny, if you're listening, I was talking with a jeweler online yesterday, and I was giving mm-hmm. him an address to get a hold of me, and my website is in it, and he looked at it, and he wrote me back, and we were talking about a piece of jewelry, okay? So totally nothing like any of this. And he told me that he had just turned 60, he had just turned 63, and that he wanted to buy my book because he was starting to think now more about what
mm-hmm.
happens. And I think, you know, like you described, when we were a kid, that awareness is kind of there. When it comes
yeah.
to your parents, you do feel like for the longest time that, of course, they're always going to be there.
Right. Yeah.
And then you start coming to an age where their friends start dying, your
mm-hmm.
friends
mm-hmm.
start dying.
Yeah.
And you're more aware of the fact of death,
right, yeah,
than even though it was a concept you knew was true. You didn't think about it because
right.
you didn't have that personal knowledge of it. And the older you get,
right,
the more you see it happening to people around you, and that plants the question because you're aging as you go, and knowing that,
right,
you know, as you're thinking about those people, that that's something that you're going to be
yeah,
experiencing as well. It's more real. And so, you know, just last night, talking to this random jeweler online who I don't know, I was talking about jewelry, brought that up, you know, yeah, you can buy my book, but you ought to listen to my, I also do radio. You might want to listen to my radio show, Timely. You know, I mean, and it's funny how things happen, because that's how they happened for me too, where things connected that if they wouldn't have happened exactly like they happened at the moment that they happened, that
yeah.
it wouldn't have unfolded exactly like it did, which was the way it was meant to. And I think, you know, I see the same thing in the random cousin calling
yes.
and Christina
oh, yeah.
getting that message, your sister listening to the radio program that just
yeah.
happened to
right.
come on at the time, you having a specific question when you went to see that woman that was on the radio, and then went on through further when the skepticism set in, went further on that journey and talked to more people about it, and then that became
yeah.
your reality. But what do you think about the why? Well, for one thing, I suppose they don't get funding because the people who put the money out for that and fund that kind of science, you're right, it would be hard to prove that kind of science unless you talked to enough people and they had enough qualifiers, I guess. But then what purpose would it serve for whoever's funding it, I suppose? And I'm just musing out loud with you. Because I've known the reality that it's generally not taken as a truth in the scientific community, the ones that cross over into a spiritual community, or can at least accept a spirituality side by side with the science, you know, still believe in science,
mm-hmm.
but have an open mind and a greater depth of knowledge base, I guess, that, you know, obviously funding things like vaccines, and, you know, obviously that's going to have a purpose. I don't know if anybody would be, what, altruistic enough to let people know what the truth is, or that it's too hard to quantify, because it would be hard to quantify. I don't know. What do you think? You're the one that talked to all these people. I didn't ever talk to any scientists about it. I mentioned it to a couple of the doctors, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that there are some quantifiable aspects to all of this, right? So there are multiple lines of evidence suggestive of consciousness's separateness from the brain, the ability of the consciousness to not be confined to the brain, okay? So near-death experiences, for instance, is one. Now, in of particular interest to science in the realm of near-death experiences are what are called veridical NDEs. So that's where someone who has died and had an experience, they see or they perceive something in some way while they were dead that they could not have seen by any normal means. And we have a lot of cases like this. And so in a one that's typical, if we can use that word, because of course near-death experiences are varied and individual, and they're, you know, there's a never-ending variety of how they go, but there are often some things that recur, sort of some themes or some occurrences that tend to be that happen more often than not in a lot of these that we know about.
Familiars.
Yes. So in the ones that are of the most interest to science, for instance, you'll have someone maybe who is having an operation, right? So they're under general anesthesia. And the way general anesthesia works is it makes consciousness impossible, consciousness at least as defined by science, by medical science, right? And general anesthesia shuts down the, you know, so you can't be having any, you shouldn't be having any dreams, any thoughts, nothing. That's what general anesthesia does. You're out. So in the best cases, someone's having, say, an operation under general anesthesia, and we have them hooked up to all of the monitoring equipment, right? So we have their heart hooked up, we have their brain hooked up, so we know what's going on in their body. And then they say they go into a cardiac arrest while they're in the surgery, and we know exactly what time that happened because all of that stuff is recorded. So they go into cardiac arrest, we know that there's no heart activity, and then we know that there's no brain activity, right? During that time, let's say that person claims they come out of their body and now they rise up to the corner of the hospital room and they witness, they claim that they see what's happening. They see the red shoes, for instance, that one of the nurses was wearing with rainbow shoelaces, right? They see that. Then, in even better cases, maybe they go down the hall to the waiting room and now they see their family, they're perceiving their family, and they listen to a conversation they had and they can repeat word for word what was said down the hall during the time that we know, because of everything's recorded, that they were dead, right? So we have a lot of cases where stuff like that is claimed, and yet science has not accepted it en masse anyway, right? In general, science has not accepted these cases as proof for some reason. Perhaps more extraordinary cases, we have people who have been blind from birth when they've had a near-death experience. They have been, in some cases, their ocular nerve never even connected to their brain. So there should be no way for a visual signal to get from the retina to their brain, right? There's just not a connection there. But they die, they come out of their body, and then they have a fully visual experience while they're out of body. Then they get slammed back into their body, you know, they're resuscitated, they come back, and now, of course, they can't see anymore. But they're able to tell us about what they saw, quote unquote, while they were out of body. There's a great book by a guy named Dr. Kenneth Ring and Sharon Cooper from the University of Connecticut, UConn, who wrote a book called MindSight. That's a collection of case studies of this type. And that line of evidence alone, when I read that book, I was like, well, this alone proves that the materialist scientific paradigm is wildly incomplete. This line of evidence alone. But that's not the only line of evidence. So in the book I write about, there are children who have memories. They claim to have these memories of previous lives that they've lived, right? And in the best of these cases, they remember so much, they remember so many details that they are able to track down who this previous person was. And as it turns out, all of the details that that little three-year-old kid has been saying over and over and over again turn out to be accurate for some previous person. So you'll have a kid say, you know, I want to go to my other mommy. Mommy, I want to see my other mommy. Her name was Barbara, you know, and we lived on Roxbury Street in Mississippi. And we had a dog named Boo, and I had a little sister named Kathy or whatever, right? And then eventually, in a lot of these cases, enough details are given that they're able to track down that person, Barbara, who did have a son, and the kid says, let's say he said he drowned. And the kid, sure enough, did drown, and he did have a sister named Kathy, and they did have a dog named Boo, right? The chances, the statistical odds that all of those details would match by chance is astronomically small. And it hasn't only happened one time. At the University of Virginia, the Division of Perceptual Studies, now the University of Virginia is one of the top universities in the country, right? It's perennially one of the best public schools in the country. There's a guy named Dr. Tucker, who is the head of the division there now. This work was started by a guy named Dr. Ian Stevenson, a brilliant scientist named Dr. Ian Stevenson. So for 60 years now, they've been collecting this data, and they have over 2,500 cases that are quote-unquote solved, where the kid has given enough information to identify this previous person. And the data is stunning. It is stunning. When I went down there to interview him, to interview Dr. Tucker, and this is all in the book, by the way, I was stunned at the level of evidence. Stunned. And I was shocked that this had not been taught in one of my college classes. The evidence is so strong to me that I was surprised I had not ever heard about this before. And I asked Dr. Tucker, why? Why is it, if this evidence is so strong, question that is so profound, right? This question affects potentially every human being on the planet, the idea of what might happen after we die or what maybe happened before we got here. This is a profoundly deep question that affects every single one of us. Why don't we know about it if the evidence is so strong? And we talked for a long time about that. And I think there are multiple answers to it. For me, what stands out is something that you mentioned earlier. I think that it involves ego, the ego of scientists. If you spend your whole life on a particular course of study, right? If you're a biologist and you've spent your whole life studying the brain, say, you're a neuroscientist, and you've come to very clear conclusions and you've done lots of research, and you have all of these letters after your name, we as human beings, we tend to start to identify with our work, right? It becomes a part of our ego almost. And if something about our work is threatened, it's almost as though that's threatening to us as individuals somehow. So there's something called cognitive dissonance, right? Which is a well-known psychological thing that happens. And what it basically means is that the human brain is really good at dismissing information that does not comport with its sense of reality, right? If your brain is set up in whatever way that it is, that it believes the things that it believes, and you are comfortable in those beliefs, your brain is really great at protecting those beliefs. And if information comes before that brain that threatens those beliefs, the brain is great at dismissing it as though it had never even heard it. And Dr. Tucker, when we talked about his research, that again is so voluminous, I mean, it has got just this pelagic amount of data that in my mind very strongly points to the idea that reincarnation is a genuine phenomenon. I think in Dr. Tucker's mind, cognitive dissonance is one of the main reasons that it's not known, because people just either they simply do not look at the data, Like, the average scientist out there in America does not even know that this data is there. They don't even know that this research exists. And some that do don't look at it closely enough because of whatever psychological reason is keeping them from doing that. When scientists give it a fair shake, when someone looks at that stuff fairly, they almost – it's inevitable that they will come away with at least the feeling that there is something here to look at. For instance, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is one of the most respected scientific journals in the world. If JAMA tells us tomorrow that chocolate is good for us, we actually found out that chocolate is kind of good for you, that would be on the nightly news, right? It would be on headlines.
Yeah.
People would be out partying in the streets. Oh, my God, chocolate is good for us. But when JAMA, the book editor for JAMA, looked at Dr. Stevenson's work, particularly reviewing one of his books, the book editor of JAMA said that reincarnation is the most likely explanation for this data. The book editor of JAMA said that, and no one heard about it. No one heard about it. So, again, okay. The reasons are multiple, I think, for all of that, but the fact of the matter is there is evidence out there. There is a lot of it, and in my mind, very solid evidence suggesting that we are much more than our bodies. And I'm sort of also, as you said, I'm at the point now where if a skeptic, and I think there's a difference between like a skeptic and a debunker. To me, skepticism is good, right? It just means that you're paying attention and that you're looking at the information and you're looking at it rationally, right? But you take the information in. And then you have a debunker who is someone who is sort of closed off already. You know, they have a preconceived idea about what is true and not true, and their only intent is to diminish the research. So those are two separate things. But at this point in my journey, I don't spend much energy on debunkers because they're living their own life and they're having their own journey, and that's their prerogative. The reason that I wrote the book and the reason that I talk about this stuff is just so that the information is out there for people who want it. If people are seeking this sort of information, it's out there.
Well, I was wondering, one of the things that you did that I didn't, different circumstances, when I had my experience, for one thing, I was injured and it took a while for that to come back to me. It came back in pieces. And then it was right, okay, that was part of the experience, but I had some heavy duty recovering to do first, and that was where my mind was. And so when something prompted me, that colors thing came back, riding in the car down the street when some sun bounced off of some snow, making a prism-like thing through the glass, that started triggering my experience coming back. But I didn't, when did I write my book? 2012. My experience happened in 1995. But I journaled. I was home the better part of 1995, and I was journaling this recovery, and in the recovery was this experience, and then I left. When it was time for me to go back to work and want to go back to my life, not about the near-death experience, that happened was, like I say, my truth and my reality from there on out. But the hell that I had been through around it, I put the things I had journaled away, and I kind of wanted to go into, cognitive dissonance. I wanted to go into denial and not think about the brain aneurysm and what happened and the painful recovery and all of that kind of thing. And so, you know, I did go on about my life. I went back to my work and that sort of thing. And then in 2012, I wound up having some unexpected time. And that was when I wrote my book. And I didn't ever I didn't have anything to prove. And so I never did the research that you did. And when I wrote my story, it was pre-radio. In fact, writing that book is what brought me here. It was part of the chain of where I was supposed to be. The book had to come before I was being interviewed like you're being interviewed. The owner of this network heard me and was only on once a week at that time for 2 years. He had been on once a week, and what he was finding out on the other side of the country while I was writing my book over here was that the need was so great because so much was not known about brain injury, and so many people thought they were alone, you know, and polarized, and because it's an invisible malady. You know, especially when back in 1995, you know, there, believe it or not, there was no social media. There wasn't a computer on every desk. There weren't smartphones. You know, there weren't support groups. Doctors didn't know. You'd be not surprised maybe when I tell you this, but the medical profession, who can be good at saving your life, and I never minimize that, but don't know much at all, because there's not, the surgeon is the one who saves your life, and the surgeon knows about neurosurgery.
Right.
Your internist doesn't know much.
Right.
There's really not a place. Yes. There's about a dozen things that people who've had brain injuries, symptoms that not everybody who's had a brain injury has all 12 on this list I accumulated after doing this for a while. But everybody who's had a brain injury has some of the things that are on the list. Sleep issues, sensory overload, cognitive problems, our processors work slower than they did before, problems with short-term memory, PTSD, anxiety or depression, you know, mood disorder kind of things. There's a list of these things. And the doctors, there isn't really any doctor that we go and tell about these things that we're going through who really gets it. So the first line of defense is always to throw a pill at it. And the second line of defense is to send us to a shrink. Because if it's not in their purview, it's just shuffle you off to the next person. And so there's a lot of frustrated people out in the community for the same kind of reason. See, the people in the medical profession are working on their specialty. They don't have time. 2.5 million people a year. In fact, this happens to be Brain Injury Awareness Month, so I will say that 2.5 million, I think they've moved it up to 2.8 million people a year have a brain injury. And so for the medical profession to be so not well-versed on the after effects is really incredible, almost as incredible as this other. So, you know, I've seen this before. Yeah. There's a pattern here, you know, that if you don't get it, you dismiss it or, you know, shuffle them down the road. So anyway, when I wrote the book, Craig was thinking of making Brain Injury Radio 7 nights a week, and that was a little over 10 years ago. And he heard an interview and asked me if I wanted to be a host, and I said, and this goes back to your Hamilton story, he said, and I thanked him. I said, you know, he had heard my interview, and I said, thanks so much. I don't have a background in broadcasting. I'm barely computer literate. I had a secretary. Back in my day, you know, the computer was the updated IBM Selectric. And I say it with all the good intention in the world. You know, I mean, any good executive, yeah. I was a financial consultant, any good executive has to have great support staff. But it was them, you know, that used the computer, you know, to type the letters and run the proposals. You know, it was I that did the talking and the presenting and that sort of thing. And so I just said, I'm not qualified. And I don't really know anything about brain injury except, and this is the same with the NDE, I don't really know anything except my own experience. And so he said, okay, well, thanks. You know, it's nice to talk to you. Hey, by the way, were you an author before you wrote your book? No. No. And you do have a brain injury, right? Yes. You're qualified. What night do you want? How about Wednesday? Okay. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, over a decade ago. And every week, you know, and that was just meant to happen. My learning curve, and now I know a lot more. But back in 2012 when I was writing that book, I think that was around the time that, who was that kid? There was a big controversy. It was a pastor. It was one of those near-death experience books. And I didn't read them because... Yeah. I wanted to keep my story clean, mm-hmm. right? So I didn't go talk to anybody, you know what I mean? I didn't research anything. It was in my notes from 17 years before, you know, written down in a notebook, you know, from all those years before. And so I didn't want to be tainted, confused, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I didn't read any of those other books, you know, I didn't, and the people that I did talk to that rebuffed the whole idea, you know, I quit talking about it for a while. And then I used it selectively to people who needed to hear what I had to say. It brought them comfort. And in the way that that first medium felt compelled to do what she was able to do, because of a gift she had, that was when I was telling my story to people one-on-one, when that would come up and I would be let known with the same kind of nudge she was getting, you know, that this is someone you're supposed to be sharing with. Want to look at any of the other, it was the kid who, the child that almost died, and his dad was a pastor. And they wrote a book about the kids, you know, near-death experience. And because it was written in such a Christian way, it sounded like something the pastor wrote. So there you were getting into mediums and charlatans, and there's an NDE and a fake one, right, or whatever. Yeah. I'm not saying it was. I'm just saying that was the talk going on at the time. So I just wrote my story and kept my head down, you know, just didn't want to see the rest of it. So when you talk about reincarnation, I wonder, because I didn't get, my husband finished your book, and I didn't finish it yet. But, and again, I want to say for anyone who came in late, Love Dad by Mike Anthony, and check out his website at mikeanthony.com. It really is a great book. I encourage you to check it out if you've ever wondered about what happens when we're moving on. He's a very good writer. It's really well written, and I encourage you to check it out. But, you know, on reincarnation, I guess my experience didn't reveal that. What I could tell you from my experience is that our soul does leave our body and goes to a spiritual plane, the next level, if you will. And I would say more than a near-death experience, and this is just me, a near-death experience means you hear the talk about the pearly gates, right? The entryway to where you'd be going. I would say that that's where I was. And to see a familiar and the things that I would know to be true is that our spirit, our soul, has a life of its own. It does leave the body. It goes with the help of familiars to another level. But see, I didn't get to cross over. So I wouldn't go so far as to tell anyone that I've been in heaven. I think I wouldn't have come back, is my opinion, had I really been there.
Right.
I think we're allowed we're allowed to see some proof. Okay, some proof of what's beyond the gate. Picture that. You're outside the gate. You're able to look in and see it, but you're not a part of it. When my grandfather looked at me and I tried to advance willingly, wanting to go, no thought of anything else, you know, behind me, just not there. You know, those thoughts weren't there at that time. You're totally in the moment, and watching this, you're being drawn that direction. So you're being brought along the path. I got to see what I saw and wanted to go and took the step to go forward, and had it been up to me, I would have gone. But I was told not yet. And then
you had some stuff
it
left
was over.
To do.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. And so I can't say that my experience addressed reincarnation. It addressed that life is continual, that it goes on. There's something after the human existence, and that our soul and spirit leave our body, transcend to another place. And I don't think that that which looked familiar to me, I think that's part of the process as you're evolving into whatever you're evolving into. Maybe it's a spiritual being. Then there isn't any need for the human costume, for the familiar, you know, the people who see who see their relations or whatever. You wouldn't need the human body dressing to know your familiar once you had crossed over, in my mind. You know, I'm not simple enough to think that the next level looks like this one, but I think that you do. It's a process, you know, where familiars take you to the other side. And then the other side is, that's all I have proof of, is that you take that journey and that that's there. And I feel very comfortable with it. I know what it feels like. But the reincarnation thing wasn't addressed at all. And I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's
as far as NDEs go, so, you know, I've talked now because, like I said, I'm really fascinated by these stories, and they're so varied, right? They're so different for every person, and seem to maybe be tailored to each individual. A lot of people do have experience of reliving, or maybe not reliving, but becoming aware of previous lives that they've had during an NDE. You know, some people do have that experience. A lot don't, though. Like you said, a lot of people talk about a life review given the life that they just led. You know, people have that in some form. A lot of times they'll talk about that. It's a very varied thing. And, you know, who knows what it actually is? The human brain, we barely understand how the human brain works, right? We barely understand it. We're at the tip of the iceberg. And maybe these little kids, who knows? Maybe their brain is tuning into a frequency and they're just picking up clairvoyantly someone else's previous life. It doesn't seem like that because a lot of the kids have very emotional responses to this stuff. To the point where some of them are like crying every day about wanting to go to their previous family and things of that nature. But who knows what it ultimately means? I certainly don't. And you have a much more direct experience of a greater reality than I do, a much more direct experience. So in my book, I'm not trying to answer those questions because I'm not smart enough to know the answers or come close to them. The reason that I bring up the reincarnation in the book is just because the evidence is so strong that something, quote unquote, paranormal is going on. Something is. Like,
yeah,
these kids who have these memories, these are not, they could not know these things by, quote unquote, normal means. So that's why it's in the book. As to the ultimate reality of what reincarnation might actually mean in a real sort of physical sense, obviously, I don't know. I have no idea. I know that, again, some people who have NDEs have a recollection of previous lives they've lived occasionally. If we go into like things like hypnosis, people who have had past life regressions, and I know for skeptics out there, hypnosis is a big red flag, right? Because if the brain gets very susceptible to suggestion under hypnosis and all of that stuff. But it does have, for some people, tremendous therapeutic value. I don't go into this in the book at all, but some people who have past life regressions come out believing without a doubt that those memories that they've retrieved, they call it retrieving, these memories under hypnosis is real. But, you know, there's no way, I don't think, for us to say that, to say exactly what all of that means. Because, again, the human brain is just a complete puzzle. You know, it's this amazing thing that's between our ears that we just barely understand. And to me, my instinct is the brain is the sort of interface between the place that you went to and this physical world, right? It's the thing that gives us the ability to experience this physicality in whatever way. But beyond that, how it actually works and what that interface actually is, like where the rubber meets the road between the spirit, if that's the right word, and the body, you know, we just have no idea. We just have no idea how that soul that you know now that you are, right, once the body is no longer there, you know you still exist. How that part of you, the real you, I guess, interfaces with the human body, you know, we're just so far beyond answering that question because we cannot even get science to admit that people have paranormal experiences that suggest that consciousness is not made by the brain. Because, again, the mainstream materialistic paradigm, the mainstream scientists in this country who teach our kids at universities and high schools tell us that consciousness is created by the brain, that it's an illusion created by the brain, and that when the brain dies, that's the end of that consciousness. So that's the whole point of my book, is just trying to crack open the door for people who may be on the skeptical side of this, just to let them know how much information is out there suggesting that there's a lot more to learn.
Well, I really want to look at Dr. Stevenson's work and Dr. Tucker now. I am curious enough about that to know, because there's some different things, like when you talk about relatability, like I have no evidence except I really love Ren fairs and dressing up and those kind of shows and feel like I can identify with that time period. Would I say that I think I've been there? I don't know. My life, you know, I do genealogy. I've all my life I've been Italian and Irish. And then doing this genealogy, I found out that there's some Scots Irish in there. And in fact, when it goes back to like 600 or something, there's Vikings. It goes back to Vikings. Now, I started watching some videos on YouTube, music videos on YouTube. There's this beautiful girl. I wish I knew her name. Ella something. I'll have to send you guys the link to it. I'll post it. Beautiful red hair, beautiful girl, beautiful voice. She's Scottish. She's singing some really cool songs. And there's a lot of rocks up there. And in a couple of the songs, you know, she's moving her hands over the rocks, almost like you can feel something from the rocks. And what I found interesting and relatable about that, and just figured maybe that was genetic, was I've collected rocks ever since I was a kid, rocks and crystals, ever since I was a kid, and I still do. And I feel grounded when I hold certain rocks. I feel a certain kind of energy. And it almost looks like, you know, from this video, here's this beautiful girl just singing a song with cinematography that's beautiful. And she's, you know, running her hands over the rocks as though, you know, I'm like connecting, feeling the energy that she's feeling as she is running her hand over these rocks. And I thought, now isn't that interesting? Because things do come up that make the hair on the back of your neck stand up in a good way. Recognition. You know, things like the owl I was telling you about earlier. You know, I've always been an animal lover in general, you know, but but when the owl came and I did start reading about them, and they're a messenger, you know, from the other side. And I and I got the message I told you I was getting. And so I think that the paranormal is very real. There's just people that aren't open enough or intimidated or ego-driven, the reasons, you know, that we talked about that aren't able to accept it. But for those of you searching, wondering, I think there is enough evidence out there. And Mike's book, certainly, again, I would recommend check out MikeAnthony.com. And there's other stories and resources out there, and a lot of people that we've had talk about their own experiences on the show that, you know, we want to live this life while we're here. But I think there's nothing to fear about moving on. And we miss people when they go, that's for sure. They're, you know, knowing that someone's all right and knowing where they are, I don't think doesn't make you miss them less. That still hurts sometimes. But it is comforting to know. It is comforting to know, though, in a more tangible way, that that person, you will likely see them again. this is just a separation. You spent some time together in the human existence, and you will meet again. And in the meantime, there's a connection, you know, that they let you know.
Right.
But you have to be open to it. You have to be open to it. I know a lot of people that think if they see a cardinal or a robin, there's a lot of different things for people who want to believe. And for people who go to the extent that you went to, the mediums that you talked to and that sort of thing, you know, more solid evidence than someone, say, who might see, have been thinking about their loved one and a cardinal. They haven't seen a cardinal for a year, you know, but they're thinking of a loved one and the cardinal lands on the branch right outside their window, and they see that, you know, as a message.
Yeah.
And I guess who am I to say it's not, you know? And so I want to thank you so much for coming tonight, Mike, and spending time and sharing your story. It's been a pleasure talking to you and having you as a guest. And I think I'm sorry for the loss of your father. I appreciate you sharing your journey, as I know a lot of other people do, because we all go through it. And it's good to hear these messages, you know, you don't, especially things that aren't carved in stone in science, you know, you can have heard this once from me. My listeners could have heard my story 5 years ago. Well, okay, that was 5 years ago. And a lot of life has been lived since then, you know, and lost details. And so I think it's important to keep it in front of people, like the jeweler last night. Hi, Denny.
Right.
you know, like, you know, that there is something more, and that there's some of us that know it, and we have no reason to make it up, you know?
No.
It's just to share what we've found, and hopefully there's some solace in that for you as well. So thank you so much, Mike, for sharing with us and coming on the show, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much, Kim. I've had such a great time, and love hearing about your story, and I'm going to be getting your book as soon as we hang up here as well. So thank you so much for having me.
Well, I can just call and tell you my story right when we get off if you want. First, though, what I'm going to do is on our way out, and again, I'm thanking Mike on the way out, I also plug, and you'll understand this being in the show business, the independent musicians and actors, I suppose, but the independent musicians haven't been able to tour during this last year, and because of COVID. And, you know, now that back when I was buying music, I mean, I'm still buying music, but back in the day, you had to buy a whole album to get the two songs you liked, you know, and the albums got pretty expensive, you know, and now with the wonderful world of Amazon, you know, for $1.67, an artist can take, you know, the cost of a studio and the whole band and their gift of writing music and performing music, charge $1.67. Amazon gets to keep 40%. They get 60%. That isn't a lot. Touring is where a musician makes their money. Same thing really for people that write books. So during these shows, when I say that Mike wrote a very readable, great book, I encourage you to check it out. I'm going to close tonight with the song by, I have a lot of indie artists, but I've been plugging the owner of our network, actually. The band's called The, T-H-E-E, the letter R, insane, brinsane.com. They're about to come out with a three-album set that's going to be their last after many years, and a final tour, European tour, that is supposed to kick off in August. Whether it will or not, I'm not sure, but the rapture is what their last series is called. And as long as we've been talking about what we've been talking about tonight, I think I'm going to close out the night with a song called Ghost. So VRinsane.com, check them out. I'm going to close with Ghost. Good night and God bless everyone. Thank you, Mike, and I'll see the rest of you all next week. Good night.
since I've seen these colors in the tree, my dear. It's been a long time, such a long time here, babe. Maybe this year things will change. It's been a long year, and I think it's time to leave this place. It's been a long time, such a long time here, babe. Somehow so blind.